couple of books, too. And I won't give you their title, because I believe there's something that prevents me from doing that. And that part of my speech wasn't cleared anyway. So I'll leave that. You know, in Washington, D.C., of late, they've been having a little exercise called teach-ins. I'm sure you've heard about it and read about it. And today in Washington, a high administration official is sometimes faced with the tough alternatives of facing students and professors on Vietnam or facing rebels and loyalists in Santo Domingo. And since one of the men that thought he was going to be in the teach-in but became a dropout, one of my colleagues in government that didn't go to that teach-in recently went down to Santo Domingo. I thought it was only fair that I come here today and be sure that Vietnam got equal time. And so under the rules of the Federal Communications Commission, I speak to you on the subject that I know is close to your heart. Our policy, U.S. policy in Vietnam. And it's mighty pleasing to me to have the invitation to come to this great university from the People to People Committee, a program and a committee that is doing remarkable things throughout the world. Coming here today from Washington, a city that was once aptly and I think somewhat sarcastically described as a city of southern efficiency and northern charm. I find it rather refreshing to return to the clear and wholesome atmosphere of a university campus and the excitement and the expectation and the love of learning that is characteristic of a great university. Now, action, as you know, is to the politician what reflection is to the scholar. And as a political leader, it is a rewarding experience to confront enthusiastic students and the careful scrutiny of the inquiring professor. It is a welcomed, if I might add, a risky experience. And it is welcome because nowhere that I know of are solid and perceptive arguments and judgments more appreciated than on a campus. It's risky, this coming to a campus, because nothing chills nonsense like exposure to the brisk air of a university. And I've been on many a campus and occasionally indulged, I'm afraid, in a bit of nonsense. But today I hope to indulge in considerable common sense. The subject that I want to discuss with you is most appropriate for this audience, most appropriate for any audience of young people, because it pertains to the subject that should be dearest and closest to your heart, war and peace. No group should be more interested in the issues of war and peace than those who will be expected to bear the brunt of the fighting if war should come. It is therefore a natural and healthy phenomenon that war and peace in Southeast Asia should have become the subject of lively debate and vigorous discussion on university campuses across the country. I happen to be one of those that believes that the three D's of democracy have great merit: discussion, debate, and then decision. But it is not good enough just to have discussion and debate. Nor can you always wait for all the facts or eternity to be on your desk before decision. Men in public life, as in academic life, must learn how to make decision from available fact. Now, as the debate on United States policy in Vietnam has flourished during the past 6 months in particular, the United States government has continued to be challenged to match its words with its deeds in opposing aggression and in defending the freedom of friendly nation. And I believe that we have met that challenge. Our firm and decisive response to naked aggression, explained by my friend Mr. Rowan, naked aggression against South Vietnam has demonstrated to our friends that your power, the power of this country, remains preeminent, and our devotion to freedom is firm. And it has demonstrated to our foes that the United States is no paper tiger. We seek no spirit of belligerency or arrogance. We do not seek to be bellicose, but we are resolute, we are firm, and we are determined. The measured application of American power proves that we are prepared to meet aggression in whatever form, that we shall not be forced to choose between humiliation and Holocaust, that the firmness of our response to aggression in no way diminishes our dedication and devotion to peace, because peace is the business of this republic. Peace is the business of the American people. No people have given so much to that cause, and no people that I know of are prepared to give so much in the days ahead. Our action in Vietnam is a part of a continuing struggle which the American people must be prepared to wage if we are to preserve free civilization as we know it, and to resist the expansion of communist power, and to permit others to develop their countries, their way, in their image for themselves. This nation has a role of leadership, my fellow Americans. And leadership is not a privilege or a luxury. I've said to many a students in my own family, and I've spoken to many groups, and said these words, that if you want to just have a ball, if you just want to, as the youngsters say, goof off, then don't aspire to leadership. Don't aspire to be anything. But when you have the mantle of leadership on your shoulders, by design or by accident, then you have responsibility, not luxury, duty, not license, burden, not privilege. And my fellow Americans, we have, by either accident of history or because of the manner in which we have conducted our lives as a nation for almost two centuries, we have today that mantle of leadership. And it will be ours as long as we're worthy of it. But I remind you that this mantle of leadership can be lost through indiscretion or lack of faith or frivolity, or it can be taken from us because we're not strong enough to maintain it. It appears to me that our action in Vietnam is a further indication that the breakup of the bipolar world, which has characterized international relations of the past two decades, and the easing of tensions between East and West following the nuclear test ban, may have changed the pattern of U.S. involvement in world affairs, but it has not diminished it. The world of 10 years ago was primarily a contest between the United States and the USSR. It is no longer that. We retain the role of world leader, at least of the free world, that we inherited at the end of World War II. And in that role, our responsibilities remain worldwide. I went through college during the 30s. And I was one of those young men at that time in college that believed in internationalism, international responsibility, repudiating what was the Oxford movement, so to speak, repudiating isolationism, which had its center in my state of Minnesota, And if there's two things that we learn from the period of the 30s, one of them was that you can never appease an aggressor. And the second is the consummate evil of racism. If we didn't learn that from Hitler and from Mussolini and Tojo, then we have learned nothing. President Johnson has made it unmistakably clear that we intend to meet our responsibilities, just as presidents before him, every president, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, he made fearsome decisions, and he made them courageously. President Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, and now Lyndon Johnson. This isn't a matter of partisanship. This is a matter of a man who serves as president, whatever may be his name, who sees the responsibilities of this republic and takes action to fulfill those responsibilities in honor. America was in the role of the defender of the free world that we originally made when we originally made our commitment to Vietnam in 1954. It was in this role that three administrations have maintained that commitment. It is in this role that we honor that commitment today. Although as students of history, you may debate the wisdom of the original decision to take up the responsibilities which the French relinquished in 1954, to take up the responsibility of fulfilling a request of a free people after they won their independence, this question now has little relevance for the policymakers of today. President Johnson, in his Baltimore speech of April the 7th and in his Washington speech of May the 13th before the editorial cartoonists, spelled out those alternatives which we have chosen as the basis of our policy. And I think as students and scholars, you ought to know those alternatives, and they are three. First, in the face of armed conflict, in the face of continued aggressions, we will not withdraw. We will not abandon the people of Vietnam. And above all, we shall keep our word there so that people elsewhere will know that we'll keep our word there too. And if you can't keep your word there, if our word isn't good in Vietnam, what would make a man in Berlin think our word was good there? This is an inseparable world. Our refusal to withdraw, it's not based on false pride. It's based in our recognition that sudden withdrawal from Vietnam would only weaken the position of all free societies in Asia, which could only regard the withdrawal of the United States as a loss of interest by the United States in the whole area, and an inducement and an enticement to accommodate themselves to communist China. I'm sure that the leaders of the free nations of Asia, even though their words on occasion may be critical of us, do not want communist China to be master of the continent and the potential master of the whole European-Asian complex. In refusing to withdraw, we reject the belief that by some Hegelian law of inevitability, China is destined to swallow up all of Asia, and I've heard that nonsense. And I find it curious that the proponents of the inevitability theory so often combine it with a sort of self-rewarding, self-adjusting advocacy of the Titoist doctrine that Vietnam would become an independent, neutral nation if we would but withdraw our military forces. The arguments are unsupported by current history, and are incompatible. We refuse to withdraw on the certain knowledge that withdrawal would mean the betrayal of those very people who have opposed the spread of communism in Southeast Asia. And it would mean certain death and exile for them by the thousands. And finally, in relation to the Sino-Soviet contest, a withdrawal by the United States would vindicate the Chinese thesis that militancy, arrogance, aggression pays off. And it would discredit the current Soviet thesis of peaceful coexistence. It is my view that neither India nor Russia, in the privacy of their discussions, think that it would be in the cause of world peace for the United States to withdraw. Now, secondly, recognizing that a political solution of the conflict is essential, and we do recognize that, we, the American people and this American government, we stand ready to engage now, this hour, today, tomorrow, in unconditional discussions. We have no desire for further military escalation of this war. We stand ready to consider any solution which would bring peace and justice to all of Vietnam, North and South. And I would like to make it clear in the presence of the students. I'd like to make it clear in your presence, because you have a right to have a wholesome, clean position. Who is opposed or who is in favor of a political settlement? Who has offered the olive branch of peace? Who has rejected it? When I hear some critics, I begin to wonder who they've been talking to and what they've been reading. President Johnson has affirmed not only our willingness to hold unconditional discussions to end this war, but an ardent desire to do so. But what has been the response of the communist regimes in Hanoi and Peking? Belligerent arrogance, unbelievable, impolite, arrogant refusal. They have rejected every peace offer from any source. They have spurned the efforts of the UN to mediate. They have rebuked the 17 so-called non-aligned countries in their proposal. They have scorned the offer of the British, being unwilling even to accept an emissary from Britain to talk about it. They have brushed aside the efforts of the president of the Indian government. In short, the communist governments in Hanoi and Peking have rejected all efforts to restore peace and justice to the people of Vietnam. And therefore, may I say once again to the critics, the enemy is not in Washington. The enemy is in Hanoi. It's in Peking, and we ought to know it. Third, we recognize that the people of Vietnam must have a cause for which to fight. They must have a hope for a better day. We have made it clear to the people of Vietnam that to improve their lives and to fulfill their hopes, we, the American people, stand ready to support a massive cooperative economic development, not only in Vietnam, but for all of Southeast Asia. Yes, it is our desire to supply bread and not bombs, to build homes and not destroy bridges. It is our desire to save lives, to extend life, rather than to take it. It is our hope, as the president has said, that the works of peace can bring men together in a common effort to abandon forever the works of war. And we're prepared to work with foe and friend and foe alike. These three principles, honoring our military commitment, a continuing willingness to seek a political solution, and a massive economic development program, remain the basis of our policy. And I submit to this audience, it's an honorable policy that you can embrace. Now a word about the new form of aggression that we meet in South Vietnam. A new form, by the way, a bold new form, which could rank in military importance with the discovery of gunpowder. I refer to the so-called War of National Liberation. Vietnam offers a classic example of what can be accomplished by militant communist forces intent on deliberate subversion and destruction of a country from within. There we have seen a communist state refuse to leave its neighbors in peace. We have seen the infiltration of communist cadre to strengthen and direct guerrilla warfare in violation of international accords. And on two occasions, the government, the regime in North Vietnam has been accused by the International Control Commission of having violated those accords. We have seen the communists who control and direct the war from Hanoi insist that the war in South Vietnam is an internal civil war because many of the Viet Cong are South Vietnamese. We have seen them portray this struggle as a civil war in which, as they put it, popular forces are arrayed against American imperialism. What an ironical situation. What paradox. The totalitarian, using the lexicon of democracy, talking about people when they have no respect for human dignity, talking about a republic when they wouldn't know how to create one, talking about a people's democracy when they rebuke the very idea. It's this new sophisticated form of warfare that you have to face and that our nation has to face. And it's this new sophisticated form of warfare that is our major challenge to our security and to the security of all free nations. This new warfare isn't just massive armies moving across frontiers. It isn't what you read about in your history books. It's entirely different. And it's often more dangerous than the old. It's a war in which the leaders cannot be located or contacted, in which the sources of supply cannot be easily cut off, in which most of the enemy forces are indigenous, but strengthened by widespread infiltration, in which signed truces mean little or nothing and do not halt the struggle. The supreme challenge, therefore, today is to prove to our communist foes and our friends that the new face of war, as made and developed in the communist centers of power, is no less pernicious than the old, and that it can, however, be defeated by those of strong mind, of stout heart, and of a will of steel. We know now that most communist regimes do not desire to blow this world to pieces. They just want to pick it up piece by piece. The biggest real estate operation in the world's history. But how do we successfully meet that challenge posed by these wars of national liberation? It's obvious that nuclear power is not enough. It won't do any good to just talk about our number of missiles. It is obvious, too, that we need a balanced military force comprising air, sea, and land power. We need maximum flexibility in these forces, making it possible to respond rapidly to any situation. We need men that are experienced in guerrilla and psychological warfare, in all the paramilitary arts that are practiced in these so-called wars of national liberation. We must adapt our aircraft and our ships to the conditions that we find, not the conditions that we hope. We must relearn the tactics of ground warfare in a guerrilla setting and adapt our equipment and our weapons accordingly. You know, sometimes I worry because there are those that say we can't do this. It reminds me of the story about the old doctor who had a patient come in that had pneumonia. And this old doctor said, "I don't know how to treat pneumonia." But he said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "I'm really an expert on fits. What I need to do is to throw you into a fit and then I can cure you." We have today a different kind of warfare. We've learned how to fight the so-called big war, the conventional war. But we're not going to have the chance to change the patient. The patient is fighting, in this instance, not the patient, the enemy is fighting the guerrilla war. A war, by the way, which was a part of early American history in the French and Indian Wars. You might read your history once again to refresh your memory as to how the British columns did as they came through with their conventional training and were given ignominious defeat. Overwhelming military power alone, however, is not the adequate response to these wars of national liberation. And here's where we come in as a people. Since these wars feed on seething social discontent, success in countering them requires a subtle blending of economic aid, political expertise, educational efforts, information and propaganda programs combined with military power. Wars of national liberation flourish where the military struggle is but one part of a larger social and political struggle. And these struggles will continue, and revolutionary ferment will increase until governments can come to power capable of implementing systematic social and economic programs designed to abolish these shocking social and economic inequalities between the privileged few and the impoverished masses, between the glittering capitals and the festering slums, between the favored urban enclaves and the primitive rural areas. In other words, to defeat the guerrilla warfare, you need a social and economic revolution within the countries being saved. For the masses of the people in the developing countries of Asia who have never known the benefits of modern civilization, the status quo is no longer a burden to be patiently borne, but an oppressor to be cast off. They do not want the yesterdays. They want the promise of tomorrow. The primary responsibility for preserving independence and security in a country, of course, remains with the people and the government of that country. And if the people and the leaders have not the will to preserve their own independence, no outside force can save them. If the government can provide the people with a cause for which to fight, with a program that inspires sacrifice and effort, the government can be capable of defending itself against communist infiltration and subversion from within. But where subversion from within is supported by subversion from without, or on the outside, as in the case of Vietnam, outside assistance is needed if such government is to achieve the capability. In many areas of the world, your country has inherited this role of protector and defender of the non-communist nations which are under communist assault. Sometimes we defend them through economic aid, sometimes through diplomacy, sometimes through military assistance, sometimes in the United Nations. But America has had the awesome responsibility for better than 20 years now, or going into the 20th year, of defending the weak, of helping the little country, of trying to maintain some opportunity for people to build themselves a national spirit and a viable economy. It's often a painful and expensive experience, but it is an essential one, both to the security of the non-communist countries and ourselves. Now I want to refer to the little noticed side of the struggle in Vietnam, the non-military side, the struggle for a better life. It is this battle of the Vietnamese people, not merely to survive, but to build, to make progress, to move forward, that inspires me. In the past decade, for example, rice production in this beleaguered little country has doubled. Corn output is expected to be four times as large next year as it was in 1962. Pig production has more than doubled since 1955. Land reform has taken place. The average Vietnamese can expect to live today only 35 years, yet there are only 200 civilian doctors. A new medical school, which we are helping to build, will graduate that number of new doctors now each year. Meanwhile, we will have helped vaccinate more than 7 million people against cholera and millions more against other diseases. More than 12,000 Hamlet health stations have been built and stocked with medical supplies. This is what your government and our people have been willing to do. In Vietnam, as everywhere, civilization is a race between education and catastrophe. Education is the foundation of every country's future, for it's impossible to even run a government, local or national, to man factories or to enrich national life without trained and educated people. Elementary school enrollment in South Vietnam in 1955 was 300,000. Today it's 1,500,000. Vocational school enrollment has quadrupled. The university population is steadily increasing. This progress has been achieved against the most appalling odds. Put yourself for a moment, if only in terms of your thoughts, in the other man's position. It has been made despite the careful, planned, and executed program of terror, of assassination, of burnings, of harassment carried out by the Viet Cong. Now, there's a curious misconception going around this country about the Viet Cong, that it's some sort of a great idealistic movement, a sort of an Indo-Chinese wing of the American Populist Party, to use the words of Arthur Schlesinger. In reality, as Professor Schlesinger said, it's a collection of very rough terrorists whose gains have come in the main not from the hopes that they've inspired, but from the fear that they have created. These are no reformers. May I say to my friends, these are destroyers, assassins. They seek not to save life, but to take it. In the countryside, agricultural stations have been systematically destroyed. And medical clinics that have been established for simple outpatient care have been raided and burned to the ground. Malaria control teams have been killed or kidnapped. Village chiefs and school teachers and others who represent order and local government and social service have been made the special targets for assassination and kidnapping by the terrorists. All told, it is estimated that over 10,000 civilian officials in that little country have been killed or kidnapped since 1954. Translate that, my dear friends, on a population ratio to the United States, and it would mean that 130,000 mayors and councilmen and teachers had either been killed or they had disappeared. The fact that the Vietnamese fight back after this terror is something of amazement to me. Yet the effort of these people goes on despite these attacks. Brave and tireless Vietnamese continue to take seeds and fertilizer and farming know-how to the villagers. Teachers continue to man the schools, more of them today than last year, despite the constant attack upon those schools. And at their side, I'm proud to say, are your brothers and sisters.